flags, please. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Mayor Britt?
Here.
Mayor Protem Holtzclaw?
Here.
Councilor Kelly?
Here.
Councilor Michelson?
Here.
Councilor Cavallari?
Here.
Councilor Todd?
Here.
Councilor Vaughn?
Here.
Thank you. So audience communication, anybody want to talk to the council tonight about anything on or off the agenda? Going once, twice? Okay, you'll have another time at the end of the meeting. Presentation, city manager.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Officer Smith, would you join me, please? So it is my pleasure tonight to recognize Steve Smith. I'm hopeful that many of you know Steve because he's celebrating his 10 years with us here on the council of the city. I promoted him just like that. Steve was hired on February 16th of 2016. He came from a background working with troubled kids and teenagers. I'll be calling you. I'll soon have a teenager. during his 10 years with the Mill Creek Police Department, Steve's been a corporal, a bike officer, and he spent 3 years at Jackson High School as the school resource officer. Steve was the first officer to proudly wear a Jackson High School letterman's jacket, which I heard when I first arrived was a gift from the students. Is that right? While at Jackson, he developed a program on the dangers of sexting, and through that program, he educated hundreds of teens and parents on the dangers of sexting. The program continues today and is a popular teaching topic. Officer Smith is a member of our firearms cadre. His abilities and easygoing personality are the perfect combination to build the skills and confidence in others. He is a real asset to our police department. I have enjoyed getting to know him. Congratulations on 10 years of service. We have a certificate for you verifying 10 years, a pin for 10 years, and then a gift. And I know that the council would appreciate you.
One photo here. Hey, Steve, check. Yeah, there we go. Awesome. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you for being here. Okay, next up is new business, the 132nd Street Corridor and eGov development scenario assessment.
Thank you, Council. Tonight we have our consultants back from Eco Northwest, and they're going to go through the next phase of the study with you, the results of the next phase of the study. As you'll recall, we did have an initial meeting with you at Project Kickoff. They came back and shared with you their market assessment findings, and then met with you to talk about your vision. And so today they're going to talk to you about the results from the different scenarios. And there's three primary scenarios based on your input that they have analyzed. One is continuing with a strip mall type of environment. One is a more upscale retail environment. And one is multi-use. And they've also figured into their financial projections utilizing DLR funding for completion of the spine road. And so our goal here tonight is to walk through those scenarios with you, give you the information, and let you then discuss which of those scenarios the council would prefer to follow, and discuss whether or not you want to contribute towards the spine road. You have an updated packet, hopefully at your dais seat. It was also on the website, but they provided us with updated information since the packet was prepared early last week, and so we wanted you to have those latest numbers. And so I'll turn it over to our friends at Eco Northwest.
Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks.
So I'm Eric. I've seen you before. This is my colleague, Michael Wilkerson, filling in for Morgan. Michael has been helping us out a lot on the financial performance analysis and some of the other financial analysis, so he's going to be able to speak with that. So just to remind you of what the main questions of this our work here was. One was trying to understand where the feasibility of current uses along the 132nd corridor. What are the implications of the development moratorium? And also, what choices does the city have around making zoning changes, infrastructure investments, and different possible incentives around sort of realizing the type of development you would maybe like to see? So we already talked about this a bit, but you know, this is the third time we've come to you. The first time we gave an overview of all the sort of the broader market conditions. Last time we sort of sat around and talked about what things you were interested in seeing at the Ego site in terms of character. And then so today we've developed some scenarios and we're going to look at, and we've done a bunch of analysis around the feasibility of those scenarios, as well as the
fiscal benefits and the type of tax revenues, those different scenarios we've looked at.
So then we'll be able to compare those and then talk about different actions moving forward on what may be feasible and not, and what are the choices that you all have to
affect that.
That's what I said. Just
a quick reminder with the
market assessment, you know, it's really retail, housing, and groceries.
Were the primary use types
that were the most feasible along this corridor in the last several years.
Sorry, Eric.
Yeah.
Apologies for interrupting. Can we just have a look at this slide? This was in black and white in our packet.
Oh, yeah. This is the chart that we had from
2 meetings ago. And sort of just
the qualitative analysis on these number of factors, rents,
population and housing, what types of uses, and given the recent trends.
So it's really, you know,
retail because rents have been increasing, vacancies are low.
Household income is high, household growth is
occurring, and the grocery also, because you looking at retail sales tax, you have a lot more sales on groceries than you expect
for a city of this population, so there's a lot of
excess spending in that area. And then housing is just the desirable location, or amenities that will create a desirable location for housing growth. So those are sort of the three main
broad use types
that are the most likely moving forward.
We've done a little more in-depth analysis of
those different uses in our scenarios, and we'll walk through so we can get into those details as well.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I just couldn't tell if the area was red or green from the picture. So just wanted to have take a second to look at that. So, thank you very much.
Yeah.
And then just sort of recapping what we heard kind of maybe last time when we sat around, like one of the things that really came through us was that you wanted
something that was
sort of
classic or had a lot of
high quality development. Also
interested in not just your typical retail uses, but maybe
some more entertainment oriented uses or other things that, you know, just didn't necessarily want to drive all the way to Linwood or other places for people to have.
Primarily focused on retail uses, but also a mix of possibly housing, especially if there's housing above retail in a vertical mixed use environment.
But then you also were interested in understanding what are the fiscal implications in terms of
how much money the city may have to pay, and then
what are the tax revenues that you'd be getting from this, and how does that factor into your decisions? So
based on that, we developed
three different scenarios.
So the first scenario, which is considering the baseline scenario,
is really more about what's character.
The character of what's there today. So the picture you can see is
the Thomas Lake Shopping Center
across the street. This is really your one-story strip retail center. This is very similar to the characteristics of the proposed possible development
of the Penn Creek site, which we looked at.
So the total square footages of retail square footage of like almost 100,000 square feet, over 500 parking spots, sort of aligns with that proposal. And then, so for example, the type of tenants at this place would be probably anchored by a grocery store, like a Safeway,
Albertsons across the street or something like
that. And then the other
smaller tenants that would fill in would be, you know, a bank or a cafe or a salon or those type of things that you see often on along the lens.
I think quarter. So it's sort of capturing what is the general
character of
other retail development along
there.
Okay. Questions on that?
Does that make sense? Okay.
So scenario two
is one that is also strictly retail focused.
But it's really more trying to get
to a higher value,
higher quality type of retail, both in terms of aesthetics and design, but also in terms of
type of tenants
when they go there.
And in terms of overall
scale, it's right around that 100,000 square feet, has the exact same number of parking spots as under scenario one, but it's really the character of the development that's different. And so it will be anchored by a more specialty or higher end grocery store, and the other type of smaller retail spaces that are filled would be the ones that would be more attractive to that, or something you see in town center, like restaurants or cafes or even a wine bar or pet store. There could be a secondary anchor such as a fitness center or a smaller cinema.
And then also included this would be
some sort of public gathering space. So it wouldn't just be parking and retail, but it would
be sort of a green space
or public gathering space for people to rest or gather. And you can sort of see in the lower picture,
this is an example of
a similar type of development of a similar scale in Portland.
You can see the architectural quality,
some of the landscaping. That's a place that I think sort of align more with what we were hearing from your last meeting, the type of thing that you would be interested in seeing happening in Mill Creek.
Is this pedestrian friendly?
Yeah, so it's
people going to walk around and circulate in the town center?
It's all service parking and has the same
amount as the other one, but it's really how it's designed and oriented. There's
similar town center, yeah.
There's sort of like a main corridor where the street
store's front. There's a lot of parking off behind. It's all service parking. But designed to create a more pedestrian environment, especially with having sort of a pedestrian plaza area.
That's a sort of a key
point. So, and then the third scenario is really
taking that scenario two when you just saw,
and then adding
three stories of residential, well, coupled buildings, so a couple mixed-use buildings. And this one,
and the key difference is you still have close to 100,000 square feet of retail space, but the big difference is because of the additional 150 units of apartments, you need more parking. And because of the constraints of the site, that parking has to be either on the ground level of those buildings, or there's actually this scenario
also assumes there's one level of underground parking that to accommodate, just to get the
over 600 spots of parking and all that development on the site. It's only, 7 to 10 acres
of available land. It's pretty constrained, so you have to do underground parking. And
similar type of tenancy as a, especially grocery, would still be the anchor, but then you have the cafes and restaurants also filling in. So those are sort of the spectrum of the different
scenarios that we put together, and that we've
done the financial performance analysis on, and also looked at what the tax revenue is. So when we look at tax revenue, it's not just the stores and the type of stores, but it's also
the
sales tax on the construction value, so the more
development, the more initial sales taxes will go on a one-time basis, and then also ongoing sales tax
from the stores on the ground.
So now I'm going to turn over to
Mike, who's going to run through some of the financial modeling and
analysis that we did.
Can I add another question?
Yeah.
We've got some mixed use already, and the retail underneath just isn't, it's not selling, or it's not working. And so what is there about this scenario that tells you that this will be successful and people will want to come here and rent the retail? And you can do all the projections, but if people won't come to rent the retail, so what about this makes you think it'll work?
Well, so this photo is actually from the
condo building in the town center.
Mm-hmm. And these, I think, are more
useful test cases
for testing
how the financials performance would work.
But yeah, that's a very good question. If this was built from a developer's perspective, do they think they could actually get those spots filled? And that's
something Mike's going to be touching on, because that really, there's one thing to actually fill a
spot and go rent it with
the rents you assume.
But then there's the question of, is that
actually realistic? So I'm going to end up working Mike. You can run through some
quick overview of what we did for our financial analysis
and also what some of the results were.
Sure.
Thanks. So I'll try to quickly go through this,
and certainly if there are
detailed questions, I'm happy to field those,
but I don't want to put everyone to sleep with lots of terms and concepts.
But essentially what we did is, as Eric described, the three scenarios, we calculated the project value for each of the three scenarios. So that's what it's worth in the public market. So in order to do that, we used the capitalization rate for each of the three product types, and then through the capitalization rate, we calculate the income, which is the rent on retail and on scenario three residential, and then the cost of building, which is the building, potentially the road, and then also the parking. So between the revenue and the expenses, we get our net operating income,
and then through the net operating income,
we calculate the project value.
The last step we do is we said, what's the residual land value? The residual land value tells us essentially what a developer can pay for the land given the development program and achieve their minimum financial returns. So to walk you through what that looks like, we first calculate the project value. We describe that through the capitalization rate. After the project value, we deduct all of the costs. So site preparation, design permits, the construction of the building, construction of the parking, infrastructure improvements, the road, any stormwater, operations and maintenance expenses, and then we have a minimum required financial return for developers.
And that's always an interesting point because
the assumption could be, well, they
take no profit, we can just eliminate
profit, but in order to motivate a developer to take risk, they need to have some minimum requirement for financial return. So we build that into the model. What's left is
the residual land value.
So what that tells us is how much can a developer pay for the land, and it allows us to look at different scenarios and understand on the same site which ones generate more value. So it's a way to kind of normalize our decision making on top of the value and on top of the fiscal returns. So the first thing we want to do is understand the value of the property relative to what other land is selling for or has a market value of in the area. So if you look at recent sales of similarly sized commercial zone properties that are vacant, you see them selling roughly at $12 to $15 a square foot. So that's kind of our grounding sense of understanding the residual land value has to be at least $15 or it's not profitable to build. So that's kind of our baseline.
Each of our scenarios, they're above that threshold.
But it's important to ground our findings in where land is trading at currently. So as Eric described scenario one, yep.
Before we jump too far into that, so you've assumed some cap rates for this, different cap rates for different quality or, well, types of uses and quality of products, projects, but it's also somewhat dependent on the current market expectations for cap rates. Can you give us a flavor for what you've assumed here?
Sure.
And how sensitive that is to interest rates? So interest rates are going to go up sometime. How sensitive is it?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So in this, rather than taking a long-run phased look at things, which gets difficult to forecast cap rates, I get asked to do that sometimes, and it's
not easy to do.
If I could do it, then I would be retired by now. But yes, certainly we're in a declining cap rate environment, and essentially as low as we've been for certain product types, possibly ever. So understanding that generates much more value
with lower cap rates than
what would be expected for the same income going forward. So we apply the cap rate for retail at 6.5. And then for scenario three, for the multifamily space, we applied 5.5. So we're assuming the residential is valued more in the market than the retail space, which is commonplace. So what we didn't project forward, let's say in 10 years, that's certainly a great question. So you're looking at a phasing approach, what would happen 10 years from now?
You know, we would project
cap rates would probably be higher in 10 years than they are now.
But if we're trying to look at a
decision on the use of a property now, we focus more on what the value of the property is today rather than what it would be in the future.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. So using the cap rate and the income, we get to a project value of roughly $23.4 million for the strip retail. And the residual land value would be about $15, $16 a square foot. So that tells us the market is basically aligned with this valuation, and it's saying the market believes this type of development is feasible. As we look at the other scenarios, what you'll see is higher residual land values. And if the residual land value is higher than what the market is pricing land at, it would describe the fact that the market doesn't believe that type of product is feasible. So when we look into the other projections, we're assuming rental rates, and you had a great question about how likely is rent, right? So that's outside of what we would look at, and that's kind of the risk profile for the developer. But generally speaking, if the residual land value is in lockstep with what the market's at, that's telling you
there's demand for that. If the residual land values are much higher
than that, that's telling you there probably isn't the demand for that type of product right now in the market. But we can calculate what the value is for a higher form of construction. That's a different question than whether or not that's feasible in current market conditions. So when we looked at calculating the fiscal impacts, we looked at the sales tax from construction and also from retail, and then the property taxes, and we went out 30 years. We took a net present value of that. So we took the present value of that stream of income over 30 years. In scenario one, that's close to $6 million. As an example of an incentive, the road costs $6.2 million. So as an example, taxes over 30 years couldn't support a subsidy to pay for the road just on this parcel. This is not the full connection, it's just on this parcel alone. So it's just kind of grounding the trade-offs that you can make from a policy standpoint. If the road were subsidized, it would increase the residual land value from $15 to $28. So for this scenario, essentially, what we're saying is there's not really a whole lot in terms of incentive that you would need to offer because the residual land value is what land is selling at right now. You would need minimal waivers to allow for gas stations or drive-throughs if that's what they demanded. Short of that, you wouldn't need much else to incentivize this type of an action. Yeah.
What page did you use for your net present value?
Net present value?
Well, if you go 30 years, you've assumed some interest rates on that.
Yeah, let's say 5%.
4.5% or 5%. Yeah. It's 4.5%.
And the road cost is just for that section too, so I think it's keep it important to remember that there's other parts of the EGOV site that have road costs too that would not be supported by this project theoretically. So
I'm sorry, say that again.
So there's a $6.3 million estimate for the road on just the Penny Creek property. You know, there's other parts of the EGOV that the road would need to be built. So the actual total to make all those connections is gonna be more than that even.
So when you look at that
negative $260,000, that's just for the Penny Creek site
specifically.
We think much bigger to the broader EGO site, then that's probably even bigger negative number. So
how did we, I mean, we're looking at 5.7 to rebuild 35th, so how are we talking about 6.3 to do a relatively small road on Penny Creek Partners property? That seems high.
Yeah, we just took the average on the linear foot from the study that we did, and just applied it to the length of this. So,
and this was based on LRF, so you included debt service. Is that right?
This is just the straight cost.
This is just straight.
This is not the finance cost of the road.
Yeah. So. I think it's just we include the road cost as a theoretical way to understand like the cost. And then the revenues are coming in.
So even if you know interest rates were higher or lower, so the amount of tax revenues you get are different, the cost of the road is different. I think they're all in the ballpark, so you just start to understand like where the city would stand financially and fiscally from some of these developments and costs they may incur. So.
Yeah, I could maybe clarify that a little bit with the cost of the roadway. It is based on the figures from the Reed-Middleton design study that was done a few years ago, but that does cover kind of the full meal deal of the road. That would be the road, all the utilities within it, the associated stroke drainage facilities, the wide sidewalks, street lights, basically like a full town center road section, which when you include all the accessories outside the pavement, it gets pretty expensive. There could be some other options where we did a fairly bare bones road section. Say maybe we just did the pavement part and then had the developers do the frontage from kind of the curb and sidewalk behind it. So in kind of a worst case scenario, we use this number, but there may be some other options.
So I don't think we have a map that shows the other remaining parcels that it's not on. So extrapolate for me, what would we be looking at if we wanted to complete that spine road on the properties that aren't developed today? What does that 6.3 number become, approximately?
Roughly double.
And is that with or without the roundabout on Seattle Hill Road?
That would be without the roundabout.
What would a roundabout cost us?
Oh, that's another maybe $2-3 million, something like that.
How much?
$2-3 million.
We had some quotes on Sail Hill Road, and I thought, my recollection was they were 4 to 5 per roundabout.
Those were the big ones. Remember they offered us the big ones first, and we were like, why do we need the big ones? And how much for the, they said, oh, we always like to go big first, and then they dropped it down a little bit. The big ones were what you said. Shrunk them down a little bit.
Yeah, we haven't really done anything other than just a conceptual layout for the roundabout, so it's kind of tough to do a hard cost on that.
Other questions about scenario one?
Okay. So for scenario two, I want to emphasize that this is assuming absorption not being an issue,
and they're able to achieve the
rents that we're projecting. So in scenario two, we're assuming rents similar to what we're seeing now in town center, so $30, $32, somewhere in that range. In scenario one, we're assuming rents to be $5 to $7 less per square foot. So that's the primary assumption that's driving the higher valuation in scenario two versus scenario one. So whether or not those rents can be achieved is a different question, and the likely answer is no, because we're seeing residual land values at $30 or more a square foot here,
and land isn't trading at that. So that's telling us the market doesn't believe that this type of a
product is currently feasible. What we've modeled is
the assumption that it is feasible, so that we can see
what the potential value of the site is, given the market conditions that would support that. Alternatively, you could just say the market doesn't support this and not even look at the option.
Rather than doing that, we want to project
what it could be worth given the rents that are currently being achieved in town center. So with those higher rents, the project value goes up to $43 million.
The residual land value increases from
$16 a square foot to $32 a square foot. So there's much more value in providing for higher quality form architecture and attracting tenants who can pay and support higher rents. Also, it supports a public plaza space that isn't supported in the baseline scenario.
So this is, you said the town center. So this, the rates that you're assuming here are similar to the town center?
Yes.
So if it's working in the town center, why wouldn't it work here?
It's not that it wouldn't work here. It would work here. The question is whether there's the demand in the market for that much to be absorbed currently. So if you built it, essentially, would you be maybe adding vacancy here to support additional units there, or is there enough demand in the market right now to support that? The rents that we're seeing show that tenants are able to, if they can operate a business successfully, support that type of a rent, but it's not suggesting that there's demand by tenants for additional space. So as demographics grow and demand grows, the demand would be there for that type of a product, which could achieve these rents. Whether or not that could be achieved now, that's
kind of the big unknown. Our presumption is
that it can't be currently, given that the proposal that was received was for the strip side retail versus this. And the reason for that is the residual land value, so the return on the developer is higher in this scenario.
And if it could be supported,
this is what you'd be seeing proposed on the site rather than the alternative.
I think another point is the town center is almost three times the size of what this site would propose. So you just have a much bigger center of gravity, more stores that when people can come, they can, you know, go shopping at the grocery store, go to the bookstore, and then go to dinner or something. You know, there's just more there that helps attract more people, which drives value as well. So a smaller site is a little trickier. But this developer in Portland has done smaller retail developments on this scale. There. So there is, in different locations, there are developers who have found a way to make it work. But there's actually, we couldn't find any examples of something this scale in the Seattle area, and it may just be, there needs to be an enterprising individual who takes advantage of it and can reap a really big profit if it can get us right. But so that's some of the challenge and risk associated with doing something that hasn't been done somewhere in this area yet.
When we look at the tax revenue again, same story, 30-year net present value, it's higher than in the original scenario. What we start to look at here is, if the market isn't ready to support this, then something like subsidizing part or all of the road cost is an incentive that could tip something from not being feasible. Other options are, which are incremental and not as impactful as road cost, would be things like reducing impact fees, streamlined permitting processes, those types of things, but those aren't going to have nearly the incentive that the road costs would. So again, this is assuming that those rents can be achieved and additional value can be achieved, and that's how you get the